Mainstream Mental Health Radio
with Dr. John Huber.
What do you think you are, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
We're on a mission from God.
News, issues revolving around mental health.
Dr. John Huber, a mental health professional for over 20 years, the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, a clinical forensic psychologist, and a psychology professor at Texas State University. Breaking the silence of mental health one day at a time, discussing the human condition, providing a sounding board for mental health issues, and making mental health mainstream.
You got a gift, my friend.
Now it's time for Mainstream Mental Health Radio.
Let the healing begin.
With Dr. John Huber.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. John Huber. Thanks very much for listening, as we all really do appreciate it. Now, we have another fantastic show for you today. Remember to check out our website at mainstreammentalhealth.org. And let all your friends know about the show. Please let them know they can listen to our podcast on iTunes at blogtalkradio.com, Mainstream Mental Health. Now, today we're going to look at four news stories that have happened this week. And we're going to start right away with a CBS News report that came out about overweight, obese children being a higher risk for depression as adults. And this is something that we've all speculated for a long time. What tends to happen, not every obese child, but a lot of them, they're obese because they tend to be more sedentary. They tend to not do as many outdoor activities and things like that. And we know how those contribute: physical activity, you know, being outside, running, and expending energy creates a healthier physical body, but we also know it creates a healthier mental body. So as if it weren't tough enough being an overweight kid, now this study shows that there are some real long-lasting repercussions for their psychological health. When you compare these normal weight kids who become overweight adults, overweight or obese youth in the study were three times as likely to be at risk for depression in adulthood compared to, again, normal weight kids who became overweight as adults. And overweight children do have a higher risk for developing major depressive disorder over their whole lifetime compared to those normal weight children, according to this study. So, sleep deprivation. Did you guys get a good night's sleep last night? I know it's very difficult a lot of times, especially now we have all this instant on-demand news from our cell phones, and a lot of people, they keep their cell phone right next to their bed, and every little beep and an alert may be waking you up and making it difficult for you to sleep. Well, we know, and we speculated again for a long time, that sleep deprivation can cause anxiety and depression. And what we've also found out is that anxiety and depression can also cause sleep deprivation and sleep problems. So good sleep is essential for our mental well-being. Just one night of disturbed sleep can leave us feeling cranky. You can be flat, worried, even sad the next day. So it's no surprise sleeping problems like difficulty falling asleep or not getting enough sleep or regularly disrupted sleep patterns are associated with anxiety and depression. And, you know, anxiety and depression, which can range from just a persistent worry and sadness to a diagnosed full-blown mental illness, are common and harmful, especially to our sleep patterns. So understanding all these different nuances and how they interact throughout our daily life is really, really important. Now, I know a lot of you may have some of these watches, these smart watches and Fit watches. I think one of them is called Fitbit, and they help you regulate and monitor how much sleep you have and how good your sleep was. Again, if you have a cell phone or a tablet connected to that, you need to make sure that that is sufficiently far enough away from your bed to actually be able to get some sleep without being disrupted by the alarms and the alerts that are going off on those devices. And make sure you take care of that, because we do know that sleep problems can be a key factor. They can help you regulate your sleep, or they can help you regulate your anxiety and your depression, or they can exacerbate it if you're not getting it. So as basic as it sounds, sleep is very important in our daily life. All right, you're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. My name is Dr. John Huber, and it's just not Chris Cornell. Suicide rates are highest among middle-aged men. And NBCNews.com tells us that it's just not Chris Cornell, and a new study shows that the 52-year-old Seattle grunge rock icon Chris Cornell had killed himself after a concert in Detroit, shocked and saddened fans everywhere, myself included. But perhaps even more shocking is the fact that Cornell was one of scores of middle-aged men who took their lives on Wednesday. Actually, the numbers are approximately 121 Americans died that Wednesday, and this is their daily average rate every day, according to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. Of those 121, 93 statistically are men every day. Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office declared Cornell's death a suicide by hanging. His wife has disputed that ruling and suggested that her late husband's anti-anxiety medications may have played a role. We know that, you know, it's just a very significant issue in our society. And you break those numbers even further, you know that 22 veterans take their lives every day as well. In fact, American men make up the bulk of suicides nationwide, and victims of death by suicide are overwhelmingly white, 7 out of 10, male, and just like Cornell, between the ages of 45 and 65. So, you know, we need to pay attention to what's going on in our society, and men, you need to open up. Not be afraid to talk about mental health issues. You know, that's one of the reasons why I believe the numbers are lower for women, is that they are able to go out and talk about what's going on in their life. All right, we also see that negative outcomes in bipolar and schizoaffective disorders are linked to irritability. If you look at psychiatryadvisor.com, the research that they're showing there says that irritability has a significant influence on the treatment outcomes in adults with bipolar and schizoaffective disorder. Now, according to this study that was published in the journal Bipolar Disorders, as a result, clinicians should monitor and target irritability carefully during treatment. Now, we also know as clinicians that irritability frequently occurs in patients who are manic or hypomanic or actually depressed. So they can be on either end of the spectrum there of their bipolar disorder. So it is non-specific factor what's causing the irritability. You look at the data, they looked at 239 adult outpatients from a bipolar comprehensive outcome study. And this was a non-interventional study in which participants were assessed every 3 months for a 2-year period. In other words, they were not providing any kind of treatment. They were just looking at their whatever they were doing and their outcomes. There were 175 participants of the 239 who had bipolar 1 disorder and 64 patients with schizoaffective disorder. All of these individuals were over 19. And they had clinicians who prescribed them either an atypical antipsychotic medication or a mood stabilizer. So they were getting treatment. Of the sample, 52% of the participants reported themselves as being irritable. In the irritable group, 58% female and 41% were male, with the mean age being between 41.8 years of age. 35 patients, which comes out to 27%, scored as aggressive and disruptive on item 9 of the Young Mania Rating Scale, which suggests that a range of irritability exists within the group, period. So baseline irritability was also associated with how severe their mental illness was, the severity of mania, the severity of depression, and the severity of psychotic symptoms, suicidality, their everyday functioning, and their quality of life, but not with the actual diagnosis. So having those disturbing feelings of guilt did not also have an impact. It was based purely off the irritability. I'd like to remind everybody you're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio. This is Dr. John Huber.
And our guest today is kind of an interesting situation here. She has become a book writer, and things changed in her life to make her sit down and write a book. And having started but not yet finished my books, I know how much pressure that has to be, internal drive to make you write this book. So our author today is Kathy Berg, and she has a very amazing son, Christian. And, well, I'll just let Kathy tell her story. Kathy, welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been quite a journey, and it really took me a lot of courage to write the book because it involves a very unconventional story about my young son telling me that he had memories of a previous lifetime. And so, as you can imagine, I really worried about, you know, sharing the story with anybody, let alone the entire world.
Yes, yes. Writing a book on something like that kind of opens you up for a little bit of criticism.
Right, right. And I, you know, I even experienced that along the way. In the book, I write about that. You know, I first went to my pastor, and he kind of insinuated that my son could be possessed by the spirit of a dead person. I went to friends who said, oh, he could have learned these things anywhere. So I, you know, I've kind of heard and seen it all, and we just stay focused on the bigger message of the book that really is that our souls survive death. And that love can surpass one lifetime. So that's kind of the mission in sharing the story.
Okay, so to give a little bit of brief history, at a very young age, he was very good at baseball. In fact, was, you know, noted in YouTube, and I think now he has over 14 or 15 million views. And he had extraordinary skill throughout opening pitch, I believe, for the Dodgers. And you know, that's pretty impressive. What made you think that maybe he had this connection or reincarnation situation with a previous life?
Okay. Well, first of all, it started when he was about two, 1.5 is when he expressed a big interest in baseball. And then I put a little YouTube video on, and Adam Sandler happened to see it and cast him in a movie when he was two. And so that's really when my son started making these comments. I took him to Boston to film the movie, and he saw a big picture of Babe Ruth. And that was kind of the first thing he said to me. He said, Mommy, I don't like him. He was mean to me. And I thought it was strange, and I didn't really know what it was. But later when we came back from that trip, he started saying things like, Mommy, I used to be tall. And I would say, sure, you're going to be tall someday. And then he'd say, I was a tall baseball player. And I'd say, sure, you're going to be a tall baseball player someday. And one day he got so upset with me and said, no, I was tall like Daddy. And so I finally started listening to him, and I said, you mean you were a grown-up? And he said, yes. Yep. Yeah, it was very strange. And the one thing that really caught my attention, we were in an elevator one time, and he said, this elevator kind of looks like a hotel. And I said, yeah, it does. And he said, when I was a tall baseball player, I used to stay in hotels almost every night. And I kind of, you know, at that point I was kind of joking with him, and I said, oh, did you fly in airplanes? And he said, no, mostly trains. And which was very strange because he'd never been on a train,
right.
Never played with a train. And so it just kind of piqued my curiosity. So I went on the internet, I Googled, you know, Babe Ruth travel on trains, and found out that yes, that Babe Ruth played for the Yankees in the 1920s and they did travel on trains. And so I would just put pieces of the puzzle together. So as he told me more and more and more things that turned out to be historically accurate, I started to take it seriously.
Wow. So, what eventually led to him identifying or who he was in a past life?
Who he was. Yeah. So I ended up finding a woman named Carol Bowman, and she was really helpful to me. She wrote a book called Children's Past Lives. And she guided me and directed me on how to speak to him about it and ask him questions without being leading. And she suggested
right.
that I show him photographs. So what I did is I showed him photographs of Babe Ruth's baseball teams, and I said, do you see anybody in here who might not like Babe Ruth? And so he immediately pointed to this tall, stocky guy with dimples, and he did it over and over again in each photo. And then I did research to figure out who that player was. He pointed to the player and said, "That's me." And so it was Lou Gehrig, who's a left-handed baseball player for the Yankees around the same time, and my son is left-handed. And we went back and looked at videos, and there was a lot of similarities even between the mechanics of Lou Gehrig and our son at a very young age. Like, this was when he was just starting to play. Actually, I did that when he was about four. He had just started playing travel baseball. And so just all these different things. It was almost like putting together the pieces of a puzzle as the pieces would come out, because he only spoke about these things generally late at night, right before going to bed. It would just kind of pop up that he would say things. Right. Yeah.
Now, I think there's even more to it. I mean, if I'm correct, your son is of German descent, and so was Lou Gehrig. So there's some history there, too, as well.
Right. And we're not baseball people. Christian's father, my husband, is actually from Germany, from the same town that Lou Gehrig's parents immigrated from, ironically. Yeah, so
wow.
The whole baseball thing was really out of the ordinary for us to start with.
This is kind of overwhelming, and I know your Christian belief and faith, and you know, you even said you went to your pastor and talked to him about the whole situation. How did this whole idea of reincarnation affect your belief and religiosity?
Yeah, you know, it really sent me on a spiritual journey, like a quest, so to speak. And what I did is I went back and I looked at the history of all religions, you know, and I found that the common themes were compassion and love and the belief in a soul that survives death. But what was most interesting is I found a common thread in the mystic religions, in Jewish religion and in Christianity, these scriptures that had been taken out of the Bible, like back in 300 AD during the time of Constantine, where anything that referred to rebirth or reincarnation was forbidden. And to even speak of the concept of reincarnation became a crime punishable by death in 385 AD. And so just learning about this, I thought, wow, maybe that's where my guilt is coming from, to even think about reincarnation. It really felt kind of, you know, sinful or not of God to even think about reincarnation, because it just wasn't part of my faith.
Well, I mean, isn't rapture in a sense a way of reincarnation? Isn't that still talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In the end, you know, it's really interesting. In the book, what I really tried to do was just tell our story, all of the evidentiary moments, and really let the readers decide for themselves what happened. There's definitely, I mean, if you read the book, you'll see that there's proof that our souls survive death and that there is another dimension that this information came through from. And I really let people decide for themselves whether they think it's reincarnation or channeling, whatever makes sense to people. You know, I just kind of leave it open.
Well, and if you look at quantum physics, you also see some parallels. You know, they talk about how energy is never destroyed. It just changes form. And then at death, there's this 21 grams that's unaccounted for when the person dies,
right,
in body
right.
mass. And
right.
maybe that's the soul, the energy.
The soul. The energy of the soul, yeah. That makes perfect sense. Yes.
Well,
what's most interesting is that none of us will have the answers, right? I always say that, like, no
right.
priest, no rabbi, no scientist. And we really can only respect it and be in awe. But I think that our story can really give people faith. You know, people who've lost a loved one, that's another big reason I wrote my book. So people who are grieving the loss of a loved one and just not feeling the presence of that person or thinking, will I ever see them again? I think my book gives people a lot of hope.
So through your journey with Christian and planning and writing the book, were you able to identify maybe other parents who are kind of experiencing the same type of stuff and other children?
Right. I have gotten, you know, we were fortunate to meet Dr. Jim Tucker from the University of Virginia School of Medicine. And they've been researching cases of children's past lives since 1967. They have thousands of cases on file. But their strongest case is a boy named James Leininger, who had memories of being a fighter pilot in World War II. Very specific, detailed memories. And that he has a book actually called Soul Survivor. And Christian was lucky enough to be able to meet James about a month ago. He came to Los Angeles by himself because he's 19 years old now. And he and his mom and I have been in touch through Facebook. And we ended up taking him to dinner. We went to the Santa Monica Pier, and the two of them were like two peas in a pod. And it was actually the first time that James had ever met a child with a similar experience to his own. So it was very special, and special for Christian too. Yeah. The one thing that wasn't great, James told them all about how he was bullied in school. So Christian was worried about that. So far, we've been good in the bullying department.
Well, you know what? It may have been him trying to prepare him and protect him,
right.
You know, to be
really
careful. So,
him. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, how do you think all this, I mean, you know, I'm here about mental health, and it's a big concern for me. And how do you think this reflects, because honestly, if you walked into a psychologist or psychiatrist office and started claiming this, you know, we would start talking about a shared psychotic delusion of some sort.
Right. They would ask to schizophrenia running your family. Yeah.
Exactly. So, so how would you suggest someone like myself as a psychologist, how would I go about if somebody walks into my office and brings their young child in and says something similar to what you do? I mean, obviously, you know, Lou Gehrig's already taken, but, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, maybe Michael Jackson walks in the door. I'm in Austin and there's lots of music here. So what would you suggest? How would I go and proceed in this situation before I jump to a diagnosis?
Right. Okay. Well, I think, first of all, just listening to these children is the best. And letting them speak their truth, whatever it is. I've had a lot of parents reach out to me via email since the book came out with stories that their children have told them. Here's the good news, is that in all of these cases, the memories that children recall, it starts around the age of 2, and by the age of 6 or 7, the child takes on their own identity, and the memories and even the behaviors associated with memories can totally fade. And even there's cases where some kids even deny ever saying that they said these things because they were so young. So here's the good news. So really all you have to do is listen while they're telling you these things. And know that it will pass. And that was the struggle for me that I went through in the book, is like, when is this going to stop? but it does. It does. And Christian, as he got older, he said, you know, it's hard for me to remember now because God gave me a new brain. And that was my first glimpse that, like, oh, thank God, it's going away. You know, so it really is a lovely thing when the child does embrace their own identity. James told me that he's now having, you know, he's dealing with it even more. Like, a lot of this stuff's coming back to him now that he's 19. Like, you know, through his childhood, he kind of went on with his life, but now it's kind of coming back. So who knows what's ahead for Christian? I don't know. We shall see.
So what are your plans moving forward with this? I know that I hear rumors of a movie. What's going on?
Yeah, so just very serendipitously, I was introduced to the producer who did the movie Heaven is for Real and Miracles from Heaven, and he pitched our story to 20th Century Fox, and they bought the movie rights. So the screenwriter is writing the movie now, and ironically, he's the screenwriter from Miracles from Heaven, but he also happens to be a baseball guy and wrote the movie Trouble with the Curve with Clint Eastwood, a baseball movie, which is really cool. So they're writing the script now, and then they'll get talent, and they're hoping to shoot it in 2018.
How much impact or influence do you have over the script?
You know what? I was able to get an associate producer credit, but, you know, Hollywood is Hollywood, and they're allowed to change the story in some ways. One thing that was really important to me in the book was that I had to stay so authentic to what happened and the sequence of events, because our story is so odd, that it was really important to me that there not be anything fictionalized or out of place. So in the movie, I don't know what they're going to do with it, but I'm kind of trying to release my attachment to the outcome on that because I have no control over it.
Well, how is your family dealing and coping at this point? Do we have other siblings? You know, what's going on there?
Yeah, Kristen has a sister who's 3 years older. And you know what's amazing is that even in their school, in his baseball tournaments, in their life in general, you wouldn't even really know the book is out. Like, I just believe our lives are so busy and full, and people don't really talk about it. So if people are thinking things, they're not feeling, I mean, I'm getting good positive feedback, but if there's anything negative, it's not affecting us, which is great. So that's, you know, we're just really adapting. I know when the movie comes out, it's probably going to affect them more directly just because it'll be a broader audience at that point.
Right.
But hopefully it'll still be a positive experience for them.
Well, and speaking of positive experiences, is there a message you'd want other parents to know just on the surface if their child starts behaving in this way and starts bringing up historical things about, you know, maybe about how they should be as a parent?
Right. I would say don't be ashamed of it. Don't be scared of it. It's not anything to be scared of. To do the research, like the more you do the research and you find these scientific cases from the medical school at the University of Virginia, you know, these are neuropsychiatrists who are actually doing these studies. So neurobehavioral scientists, right? So, you know, it's real. It's been going on since the beginning of time. There's so many amazing stories. So I just hope that parents will listen to their children, and it's a great lesson for everyone to just always listen to our children, right? They are our greatest teachers.
That's what it seems, definitely. And so with our listeners and with your advice, is there a way for parents to find out more about you and maybe even contact you and ask questions? Do you have a website?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to talk to anybody. My website is Kathy-Bird.com. We did an appearance on The Doctors recently, so you can Google some of the interviews if you want to take a peek. But really what I'm sticking with is this message that all that truly matters in this lifetime is the difference we make in the lives of others, and that love never dies. That's our purpose here.
And where can we find your book?
Our book is available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere that books are sold. It's in a few airport bookstores now, which is exciting. And the audiobook is one thing. The audiobook will be coming out within the month.
Oh, wow. Okay, so go ahead and give everybody the full title and name of the book so that they can hunt that down.
Okay, so the book is called The Boy Who Knew Too Much: An Astounding True Story of a Young Boy's Past Life Memories.
Awesome. Well, I really do appreciate you coming on. This is just a miraculous story, and I'm glad that Christian had a mother who was patient and loving and caring and didn't jump to conclusions that I think most psychotherapists and therapists would have probably jumped to and started getting really concerned. You know, that took a lot of guts and moral fortitude to be able to go through it and take your journey. And I think he'll benefit from that and does benefit from it now. So thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being open-minded.
Okay, everyone, that concludes today's edition of Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. Thank you very much for our great guest, Kathy Bird. To learn more about our show, please visit us at Mainstream Mental Health. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you here next week. And remember, life is what happens while you're making plans, so buckle up.
Thanks for listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber. Check us out on social media, Google+, Mainstream Mental Health, Instagram at Mainstream Mental Health, Twitter at Mainstream MENTL, and search for Mainstream Mental Health on Facebook. Please tune in every week to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber.
Because of something I would be.